Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, Dr. Stephen Theriot, California's top medical officer for prisons, was ousted as COVID cases rapidly rise. There are more than 5,340 confirmed cases of COVID inside California's 35 prisons. In the last 2 weeks alone, there have been 1,400 new cases. 25 people inside prisons have died from the virus. These numbers are from the California Department of Corrections tracker. Advocates and public health officials have been raising alarms about the threat of COVID inside California's prisons since the beginning of the pandemic, before the first positive cases were even reported. Many California prisons are filled beyond capacity. They are overcrowded and poorly ventilated, with shared bathrooms and dorm-style housing. Physical distancing is impossible. According to court filings, almost 40% of CDCR inmates have at least one pre-existing health condition, making them even more vulnerable. During his press briefing last week, California Governor Gavin Newsom said many people behind bars who are vulnerable and have pre-existing conditions are ready to be let out early, but have no homes to go to or plans in place. According to The Guardian, only 21 people have been granted clemency. On today's Your Call, we'll find out more about these outbreaks. How did this happen? And what is being done to help people on the inside? Later in the show, we'll speak with advocates from the California Coalition for Women Prisoners about COVID outbreaks inside California's prisons. Joining us now is Abene Clayton, a reporter on The Guardian's Guns and Lies in America project. Abene's latest piece for The Guardian is called Historic Health Screw-Up, What You Need to Know About the COVID-19 Crisis in California Prisons. And Abene joins us from Oakland. Hi, Abene. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're also joined by Anoop Prasad, staff attorney for immigrant rights at the Asian Law Caucus. Anoop represents Chantan Bun, a Cambodian refugee who was released from San Quentin last Wednesday after serving 23 years. He is quarantining at home after testing positive. That is Chantan Bun. Hi, Anoop. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you for having me.
And I should say we have some updated numbers, unfortunately. As of yesterday, we had 25 inmates who've tragically died. It's been updated today, and that is now 28. Abene, you have been following this very closely. As you write, the CDCR reported the first infection in late March. Mm-hmm. By that time, several prison staffers also tested positive. But as we noted, advocates, lawyers, so many people were sounding the alarm bells months ago. How did this happen?
Well, I mean, like you said, the moment that coronavirus cases were found in the U.S., you had advocates for prisoners and their families saying, like, that the moment this COVID-19 hits prisons, it's going to spread like wildfire. So you have that going back, towards the beginning of the year. And in those alarm-sounding conversations, the only solution that was pointed to as being truly effective was mass releases of thousands. The California prison system has historically been overcrowded for decades. So mass releases was the only answer, and especially the mass releases of people who are 60 plus, who have these pre-existing conditions, and prioritizing their release was just, people were so insistent on it, but that was never done. Early on in March, Governor Newsom called for the release of around 3,500 people, and those were folks who were going to be out and paroled within 60 or 90 or so days. So that was the first kind of round of relief, and it didn't have the impact that many were hoping for. It was really a drop in the bucket when you look at the almost 120,000 people who are incarcerated in California's prisons. So without those, so that's just one piece. Without those releases, the density, the dormitory settings, it was just ripe for the widespread infections that we're seeing. And then that coupled with staffing, what looks like staffing issues, staff getting sick and being short staffed, and people having to go from housing unit to housing unit and just not being able to control movement and being overwhelmed just by the sheer number of people that were in there, folks coming in and out. It just, it all came together and brought us to where we are now, that combination of issues that advocates had been saying will lead to what we're seeing. The actions that folks were hoping for just simply weren't taken early on.
Anoop, what would you add?
No, I think that's absolutely right. But yeah, I think what we're seeing here is a long-term failure that's being exacerbated in the short term by utterly incompetent management by Governor Newsom and CBCR. And in long-term, the fundamental problem is our California prison system is horribly overcrowded. We built prison after prison after prison and kept packing them until they're full and then kept putting people in them even after they were full until the Supreme Court finally ordered California to depopulate because it reached a level of cruel and unusual punishment. But the system as a whole is at 124% capacity. Some prisons are at over 150% capacity. It's impossible to socially distance. And then in the short term, you're seeing horribly mismanaged transfers of COVID-positive people from prison to prison, transferring COVID, and then also CDCR continuing to transfer people from prisons to ICE detention facilities, spreading COVID even further around the country and even around the world.
So for people who haven't been following this very closely, I want to make sure we have these numbers right. Abene, as you report, 1 in 3 people behind bars at San Quentin have now tested positive? 1 in 3?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the day I wrote it, it was nearing 1 in 3, but it's firmly there at this point.
And Anoop mentioned the transfers. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about this. You have written extensively about this. You report that at the end of May, 121 people mm-hmm. who were considered high risk of infection were transferred from CIM, the California mm-hmm. Institution for Men, to San Quentin, and 66 were transferred to Corcoran. Before the transfer, San Quentin had 0 positive cases, mm-hmm. Corcoran had 1, and within 3 weeks of the transfer, the prisons had nearly 500 and 150 cases respectively. Were these people transferred in the first place?
Yeah, well, at CIM in Chino, there's an ongoing court battle, and there's a lot of pressure from this 3-judge panel, and there's pressure for the state to make a move, to give relief and in lieu of actual releases, letting people out, everyone involved in the case and some of the medical professionals felt that it was most prudent to relieve a lot of the strain on CIM to move people over to San Quentin and Corcoran. Both of these prisons are at 115. We're at 115% capacity when this move happened. So the decision was made. It's a little. For me, it was a bit murky to get to the actual bottom of how this decision was made and who exactly thought it was the best recourse, but it sounds like a combination of people involved in the lawsuit, the ongoing Plata Coleman lawsuit, as well as CDCR officials to give something that looked like relief to CIM, but has really made a huge, been a huge misstep in hindsight.
Anoop, at a Senate hearing, Assemblyman Mark Levine called the transfers the worst prison health screw-up in state history. What else can you tell us about this transfer?
I think that's absolutely right. And, I'm hearing from folks inside San Quentin that CDCR is staging to transfer people yet again out of San Quentin. And there's simply no responsible way to transfer people from prison to prison. You can't quarantine anyone after they've been tested. So at the moment you transfer them days, weeks, and in case of CIM, months later after they were tested, you have no idea if they are positive when they get on that bus. So there's going to be no way for CDCR to tell you with certainty that the people they're moving out of San Quentin do not have COVID. If they tell you that, they're simply lying. The only responsible thing that they can do is release people and depopulate the system as quickly as possible.
Today, we're speaking about the COVID crisis inside California's prisons with Anoop Prasad, staff attorney for immigrant rights at the Asian Law Caucus. Abene Clayton is a reporter on the Guardian's Guns and Lies in America project. And if you have any questions about what's happening inside California's prisons, if you work with prisoners, if you have knowledge about this issue and you'd like to share anything, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Anoop, can you tell us who are the ultimate decision makers here? We got a tweet from Jay who says, isn't California corrections the responsibility of Governor Gavin Newsom?
Absolutely. Ultimately, this is Governor Newsom's responsibility. And these people are, you know, in the care of the state of California, and ultimately it is Governor Newsom. Underneath Governor Newsom, it's Rolf Diaz, the secretary of CDCR. But ultimately, everyone reports to Governor Newsom, and he has the power with a stroke of his pen to release people, depopulate, and stop the spread of COVID inside and save lives.
Yesterday, he was asked during his press conference if he was going to visit one of the prisons, and he spoke for about 3 minutes and never answered the question. So we do know that just yesterday, Dr. Stephen Theriot, California's top medical officer for prisons, was ousted as these cases rapidly rise. Anoop, what are some of the other changes that you'd like to see right away?
Well, first, I think CDCR needs to stop the transfers. They've stopped transfers from jails to prisons, which they had restarted briefly, but they need to stop transfers between prisons. Second, CDCR needs to end its policy of transferring people from prison to ICE. In the best of times, working to deport Californians is a terrible policy, but during a pandemic, it's lethal. And then finally, Governor Newsom needs to exercise clemency power in very large numbers to release people immediately. To depopulate the system, to stop the spread, and save people's lives. And, you know, there are thousands and thousands of people inside the prison system who we can release tomorrow who pose no danger. Contrary to what Governor Newsom is saying, people have families outside who are willing to house them. The governor's office can work with community organizations, nonprofits, faith organizations to set up housing for folks. There are solutions. Governor Newsom's simply just not looking for them.
Well, I want to play a clip. This is an audio letter from Larry Wallace, who is inside San Quentin. He tested positive for COVID-19. And his fiance shared this audio letter with us. And this is from KALW's Uncuffed podcast. Here it is.
My name is Larry Williams. My inmate number is G61205. I'm housed at San Quentin State Prison. I'm in 1AC53. Stands for Adjustment Center. I tested positive for COVID on June 11th. I was placed in isolation 4 days later when they should have placed me the same day I tested positive. I believe that I caught COVID because I was an inmate worker in South Block in the Alpine Reception Unit, and I handled the property of the inmates they brought from Chino, which I wasn't even supposed to be handling, but we were tricked into doing it. And me and five other inmates, we carried hundreds and hundreds of boxes of property up to the fifth and the fourth tier outside of the wing in the hallway of South Block. And then immediately, I told my fiance on the phone that night, I started to feel sick. And then the next morning, before I could even let the staff know, they called me for a test. And then once I let the staff know, they were like, oh, well, it's okay. You know, they had the nurse look at me. The nurse said that I didn't seem to have symptoms. And I tested positive. They're not doing much for us. They're not properly doing our temperature checks. They're not properly taking blood pressure readings on us. And a person like me who has that high blood pressure, I take hypertension pills. I started off with low blood pressure. My blood pressure was 97 over 46, and then it was 88 over 33. And they were afraid that my heart was going to stop, so they told me to stop taking my blood pressure medication. And then, since I've been here, they haven't given us clean bedding. They barely shower us every other day sometimes. They allow us to use the phone a lot, but I outside of that, we're treated like we're in their way. They're more mad that they've lost staff members instead of that they're the reason why they've infected us. Once again, my name is Larry Williams. I'm housed in San Quentin. I'm a nonviolent offender. And I believe that they should start releasing people, especially people like me. I'm not just saying it because it's me, but my nonviolent release date is in March. And I own the home to go to. And I appreciate you for listening. Once again, they infected me. You can hang out, baby.
That is Larry Wallace, who is at San Quentin. He tested positive for COVID-19. Thanks to Aaron Wallace, Larry's fiance, for sharing that audio letter with us. And thanks to KALW's Uncuffed podcast for connecting us with this audio. Can you talk, Abene, about how people who have tested positive are being treated? After this segment, we're going to talk about what's happening in women's prisons. And there was an incredible piece in the San Francisco Chronicle about how people are being quarantined in isolation with little ability to leave their cells, only sporadic access to email and phone calls. What is happening at San Quentin?
Yeah, in San Quentin, well, in addition to, as you mentioned, people being quarantined in, like, pretty, I mean, colloquially, it's called the hole, but a adjustment center is the shoe, et cetera. It's in isolation where they are just in a room by themselves. The folks that I've heard from and advocates that I've spoken to tell me that people are in there being checked on by staff very rarely, maybe once a day, if that. Many of them have been, you know, virtually completely cut off from being able to talk to their loved ones, having access to the canteen or commissary to get hygiene products and anything that can bring a little bit of, you know, comfort to a really terrible and tragic situation. Additionally, I'm hearing that I spoke to someone who also tested positive in San Quentin. He was kept with his roommate. It was unclear whether the roommate had tested the roommate had tested positive or not. But I've heard that a number of times in San Quentin and other prisons that they're keeping cellmates, bunkies together when one tests positive and the other doesn't. And honestly, to my surprise, people who were in that situation said that they, you know, for being in such a tough spot, wouldn't want it any other way, because just the idea of being isolated, alone, sick, and in pain, just the toll that that takes on somebody mentally was too much for a few of them to fathom. So even if they are with somebody who they are worried about getting sick as well, just it's the lesser of two evils, with the most evil being complete isolation and being cut off from your attorneys, your loved ones, and really anybody while going through COVID.
What would you add, Anoop? Again, over 1,100 people have tested positive. So that means over 1,100 people are now in isolation. And how are you getting information about how they're being treated?
Yeah, so I think San Quentin's actually at 1,300 positive. But so at San Quentin, they quickly ran out of space in the adjustment center to quarantine people. And so, as Ben was mentioning, people are still in their cells. And San Quentin is a prehistoric prison. It's open, barred cell doors, and it's two people in the cell. It's a very cramped thing. You can't even extend your hands in the cell. And people are often just housed with people who are COVID. And the other thing that's been really alarming at San Quentin is that it's gone dark. Usually you get phone calls several times a day from people in San Quentin. People are being let out of their cells maybe once a week. They're lucky for a brief phone call. And at the same time, whatever information hasn't come out, a lot of it's been coming through illegal cell phones. And so corrections officers are continuing to toss cells, search cells for cell phones to stop information from getting out, even though that's putting more people at risk of getting COVID.
We talked earlier about what the governor said about possible releases, that they that there are no homes for them to go to. You said, Anoop, that that's not true in many of the cases. Linda writes in, is there a place for men from San Quentin to go if the governor were to release large numbers?
I mean, you know, we have close to 120,000 people in our prison system. The idea that none of them have a place to go is just, you know, absurd. Anyone who's been, you know, in the visitation line at San Quentin on a family visiting day knows that people have a community outside. They have a place to go. It's simply looking for excuses to not release folks. Some folks, you know, may not have family to go to, but there's a number of nonprofits and other organizations which are happy to step in. There's also, you know, hotel rooms across the state that are empty where people can be quarantined. There are just a lot of solutions that Governor Newsom is intentionally ignoring.
What would you add about that, Abene?
Excuse me, sorry, can you repeat the question?
Sure, we just had a question. What would happen if people were released? Where would they go?
Yeah, well, like Anoop said, there are so many families who have been preparing for months to get some sort of relief and bring their loved ones home. So, I mean, in a press conference, Newsom had mentioned they have a new community supervision program where an estimated 3,500 people would qualify, but there's just so many criteria that lots of folks don't meet. And he mentioned that of the 121 people who have a really strong chance of getting out, only about 40 had somewhere to go. And that doesn't really jive with what I'm hearing from families who have large support networks, have built these communities on social media full of people who are just like, I have the space for my person to come home. I want them to come home. And the only thing is, a lot of the families who are ready and willing to take their people back, those loved ones aren't qualified for a lot of the relief because of the offenses that they're currently incarcerated for. So what I'm seeing is less so people are bound. It's just this idea that I see spreading that people are going to get out and immediately become homeless. And that just, that hasn't been the case. From what I've seen, there are a number of reentry service providers. I mean, we're talking about San Quentin, where it's a male prison, but there are so many service providers for women's prisons and for male prisons throughout the state that are ready and willing to take people, have been preparing for releases. In addition to families, there's just a really robust infrastructure of people ready to take in the folks coming out of our prisons that I just don't see being tapped into by our governor. You know, I haven't even really seen the seen him take the steps to see if this is actually happening, you know, to do the research, to do any sort of surveying. So I just am concerned that that is just a really inaccurate picture of the large support community for incarcerated folks throughout the state. A lot of them want their people home and are thoroughly prepared to take them in and do whatever post-release and help them do whatever post-release steps they need to be successful, but they simply don't have the opportunity to do so because their loved one may be in there on a violent offense.
And as we heard from Larry, who's on the inside, they're not doing temperature checks or taking blood pressure checks. As you report, Abene, on June 1st, about 20 people inside San Quentin began a hunger strike to protest these poor conditions. You also write about how difficult this is in terms of trying to get people treatment, because sometimes there's just not enough. Their hospital resources are not nearby. At least for San Quentin, there are hospitals nearby. But we now know how this spreads. And with people who are enclosed in such a tight place, and then you've got the guards, Anoop, I mean, what do you expect will happen now that we're up to 28 deaths?
Sadly, I think, you know, that number is going to keep climbing unless Governor Newsom takes action now. I mean, he should have taken action months ago. It's very obvious what the solution is from a public safety approach, from a public health approach. The only question is Governor Newsom values the lives of people inside his prison enough to expend political capital to do the right thing and stop the spread of COVID?
Well, thank you both for joining us. We'd love to have you back to get updates on this. Anoop Prasad is staff attorney for the immigrant rights at the Asian Law Caucus. Anoop, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Abene Clayton is a reporter on the Guardian Guns and Lies in America project, and you can read her latest piece, Historic Health Screw-Up, What You Need to Know About the COVID-19 Crisis in California Prisons at yourcallradio.org. Abene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about COVID outbreaks in California's women's prisons. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll find out what's being done to prevent a massive eviction crisis from happening across the country. A backlog of eviction cases is now moving through the court system, and it could get worse as unemployment benefits run out. That is tomorrow. And then we will speak with author Dee Watkins about his new book, We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. Now we are going to talk about what is happening inside California's women's prisons. And if you have any questions, comments about that, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. There are 162 positive cases at the California Institution for Women. This is according to the California Department of Corrections tracker. Joining us now is Colby Lenz, a community organizer and legal advocate with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and the Transgender Advocacy Group of California's Women Prisoners Organization. Hi, Colby. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Hernandez is a former inmate at the California Institution for Women in Riverside County. Laura is involved with advocacy efforts with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and the Young Women's Freedom Center. Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. We just wrapped up a segment about what's happening at San Quentin. And advocates sounded the alarm bells months ago before we had positive cases. Colby, can you tell us what led to the outbreaks at the California Institution for Women?
Sure. I mean, I think there were several factors. One is that the Corrections Department moved slowly to implement serious preventative measures, not just at CIW in Chino, but also across the state. So that included, you know, not allowing people to wear masks until a certain point, and then until this moment, not fully enforcing correctional officers wearing masks. It also included not allowing people to use disinfecting supplies, and the list goes on from there. And then the other main factor that we saw play out was that they were continuing to move staff between the California Institution for Men, CIM, where there had already been a longstanding severe outbreak of COVID, and they were moving staff between CIM and CIW. They're fairly near each other. And some of that staff included staff that were working in the Prison Industry Authority spaces where incarcerated people were being made to make masks 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and in, you know, tight conditions with staff from CIM. So we don't know for sure if that's where the spread happened, but that combination of their failure to prevent staff movement between a prison with, you know, at that point, the worst outbreak and the longest running outbreak, moving them into CIW, and then that combination of that plus overcrowded conditions plus this culture of disregard for the lives of incarcerated people, I think all of that led to the outbreak in CIW in May.
They were forced to make masks for 12 hours a day, 7 days a week?
That's what we were hearing reported, and I'm sure Laura can speak more to that, too. But yes, incarcerated workers, you know, do all sorts of work running the prisons across the state, and that, you know, they moved a couple of prisons, what they call their PIA workers, to do mask making. You can find some press releases about that and so on. And those people making masks were also denied access to masks themselves for a while. And then they each, at the end of the day, would be sent back to units across the prison. So two of the women in that crew tested positive, and it was soon after that we saw a massive outbreak at CIW.
Laura, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so usually with PIA, we work 10-hour shifts there. So we go in at 7 and we get off at 5, Monday through Thursday. And they had, actually I wasn't there during the time they were making the masks, but I did work there in PIA, and but they were making the masks there for outside people, and they didn't have them for themselves. So I was receiving a lot of emails due to that as well, that they weren't being able to get masks or nothing, and they were afraid of that situation, of getting the COVID.
What are people paid for doing this, working these long days?
Okay, so we get paid 35 cents an hour. That's actually the high paying.
For the PIA jobs?
Yeah.
That's a high rate.
I work the high rate of what? The pay rate? I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said that's the high rate, 35 cents an hour?
Yeah. Actually, the highest paying position there would be a lead, and that is 45 cents an hour. So,
Laura, can you tell us about what the conditions are like inside the California Institution for Women in Riverside County?
Well, actually, there it's very hard. It's more we got to do everything ourselves, because trying to get like hand sanitizer, which they don't give us, disinfect, which is cell block 64, the cell block there, we have to beg for it. So we use our own personal, like shampoo, our laundry detergent that we buy off of our quarterly boxes, stuff like that to clean, because it's very hard to get any type of supplies there. And if they do, I was a porter there for 2 years, and the staff, they have their own personal supplies there, and that's how I used to be able to get stuff when I would clean their office, to be able to put it in our buckets to mop and clean the showers and stuff in the unit, you know? So it's very hard.
Can you talk about the conditions in terms of how close you are with other people? And, well, during COVID, I mean, we've been reading so many stories about the lack of access to just basic supplies, basic soap, basic disinfectant.
Yeah, they weren't giving anything, but we're right next door to, I say about, our doors are probably about 6 feet apart, not even 6 feet, really. There's one door, and we're two-man cells, so we're probably about, I mean, if I open my door, that's the next room right there. So maybe like 4 to 6 feet, if that. They're real close to each other.
And can you tell us about the relationship with the guards? Are the guards a mix of men and women?
Yes. Majority of the housing staff there are men.
Majority are men?
Yeah.
What is the relationship like with the male guards, the overwhelming majority of male guards, and the women in the prisons?
Being able to speak to them is kind of hard. We keep our distance from them. As me being a porter, I had a lot of communication with him, with the staff there, on second and third watch, due to the fact that I had to ask them for supplies or do things. Majority of the time, it's always wait. I'll get around to it, and it's always a time limit. So it's kind of hard to be able to communicate with them. We did have one housing staff where I lived at that was very open with us, and as soon as we ask him, he gets on it, and he would do things like that. And I lived I think we had 132 women in that unit.
Colby, I'm just trying to imagine how the relationship between the guards and the women have changed as a result of COVID-19. Because, you know, people are wondering, where is the virus? Who has the virus? Is it spreading? Have you heard from anyone about that, how that relationship and that power dynamic has changed?
Sure. I mean, I think part of what I've heard that sounds different under these conditions is, you know, that incarcerated people are speaking out, both from CIW and CCWF and beyond, you know, saying that guards are treating them as if they are putting them at risk of the virus, even though they're obviously confined in cages and not able to move to the outside world. So we know that it's coming in through people who come and go, right? And so, you know, I think that that's not totally surprising, because there is such a pervasive culture of dehumanization. And like Laura said, you know, there's people who disrupt that culture here and there. But overall, there's a very high disregard for incarcerated people. So it's not surprising to me to hear people say, you know, I don't know why they're blaming us, because we are stuck here. And there's a ton of fear about being exposed to the virus because of the obviously the constant in and out of people, and then the lack of preventative measures. And I know at CCWF in particular, which is the women's prison in the Central Valley, in Chowchilla, there's a great fear right now that there is going to be an outbreak soon because more and more staff are testing positive, and CCWF, as opposed to CIW, has even more people per cell. So that's upwards of 6 to 8 people per cell, and they call that a quote-unquote dormitory setting. So the chance of spread, you know, in a very small space between that many people, when they're not more aggressively requiring testing for guards and allowing people what they need to protect themselves, but more than anything, not depopulating, because it is, you know, truly the only way to prevent the spread of infection, as we're seeing and hearing from everybody at San Quentin and beyond.
That is Colby Lenz, community organizer and legal advocate with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and the Transgender Advocacy Group of California's Women Prisoners Organization. Laura Hernandez is a former inmate at the California Institution for Women in Riverside County. Laura is involved with advocacy efforts with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and the Young Women's Freedom Center. Let's talk about some more specific examples of what's happening inside prisons. Last month, the San Francisco Chronicle's Jason Fagone wrote a really incredible piece about what is happening in prisons. He used a prison email service called JPay to record stories. And April Harris, a 44-year-old inmate at CIW who tested positive for COVID in mid-May, wrote, quote, "Someone is yelling for help over and over. No one is coming. This one is scaring me. She keeps screaming. It's piercing." And, you know, I could go on. It's really intense what is happening in these prisons. Laura Hernandez, I understand you actually know April.
Yes, she's one of my very good friends.
I mean, her writing and what she's reporting coming out of that prison is just incredible. Incredibly brutal.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about what you're hearing on the inside? I mean, based on what April is saying, people are being isolated. They are not getting information. They have no idea what's going on. And once you're isolated, you know, a lot of mental health issues start happening.
Yes, they were. I was getting a lot of emails from her, as well as a few other women that were there that had tested positive, that they weren't getting any chemicals to clean their rooms. They were getting tested. I mean, they would check them. They weren't, when the nurses were coming, they weren't even cleaning off the materials to check them. They were just going from one inmate to another. It was horrible. It was horrible. They weren't getting no ice. The water in the cells that were where they were at were dripping water, so they really were dehydrated. So, and the showers, they were only getting showers, what, every 3 to 4 days rotation, and that's if that.
Colby, she wrote that one of the toughest days was on May 19th. She said a prisoner in a nearby cell was refusing food and medicine for days, often a sign of serious mental distress. Later that morning, Harris looked across the hall into the prisoner's cell and saw large flames leaping up. The prisoner set fire to a mattress. She wrote, "I was in shock for about 2 seconds. She was so calm just looking at me. Finally, I snapped out of it and I started screaming, 'Her room is on fire. I thought she was going to die and I was going to watch her burn.'"
Yes. And that day, both Laura and I were getting emergency messages about those particular conditions. And, you know, as April reported, the people who tested positive, who were in there witnessing this happening, you know, are also extremely vulnerable. And they, in terms of smoke, inhalation, and all of that, and terrified for this person who did this, and also subject to, like, an escalating fire that the guards were very slow to respond to. So ultimately, they, you know, removed people, put out the fire, took that person away. And in that period of time, there were multiple suicide attempts like that and extremely slow response times. And that was also true for emergency medical, which we know is happening right now at San Quentin and other prisons where they're at the peak of the outbreaks and people are in these isolated conditions with even worse, you know, medical care and lack of, like, emergency response time. And then at CIW, you know, this prison has been the prison with the highest suicide rate in the country. There was a period of years where the numbers were, you know, eight times the rate of other prisons where women and trans people are housed. And so, you know, CIW has a long record of a failure to respond to emergency mental health crisis cases, and we saw that replicate under those conditions, and we are hearing the same thing is happening at San Quentin and elsewhere. And I think this is the other key point to get through to the public, is that, you know, part of the culture of imprisonment is about isolation, and the further people are isolated in those systems, and in these cases they were isolated in these COVID units and still are, the further people are from being able to have their basic rights maintained, and also to communicate with the outside about these gross human rights violations. So we, those reports coming in from CIW and now from San Quentin and Corcoran and other places, and we're very scared that this is going to happen next at CCWF, are just terrifying. Mm. And so for each of those situations that April reports, and she wrote actually a 30-page chronicle chronicling all of her time in this COVID isolated unit. And there was incident after incident of emergency medical and mental health cries for people, you know, just, and everybody in the unit would just bang and scream until there was a response. Just totally terrifying conditions.
Her writing is incredible and haunting. I mean, I read Jason Fagone's piece last month, and I'm still thinking about it. I mean, she writes about how difficult it is to not only not have the information that you need about COVID, to not know what's going to happen to you, and then to be isolated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. And they refused to give basic information to people. They refused to bring basic mental health response. It wasn't until weeks later, and Laura can speak to this too, where, you know, after after many of our groups protested outside the prison, after many call and actions to the Capitol, pulling in legislators, doing anything we could to try to stop those conditions and get medically vulnerable people out of these prisons, that they would, you know, walk around and provide people with coloring books as a mental health response to exactly those kinds of horrifying conditions that you just laid out. Mm.
Laura, what would you like to add?
I also, too, the cleaning process and all of that. I mean, they were, when they finally, after we protested there and stuff, about 2 days later, they were all actually getting ice two times a day, but they were putting the COs there were putting the ice and the trash can in the same cart, dumping the trash and giving the ice in the same cart, which is so unsanitary. And it's absurd. It really is. It was them having to beg for stuff, asking for water, asking for hand sanitizer, or, I mean, cleaning, disinfecting, clean the rooms, not to be able to get that. I remember getting an email from another one of the girls in there that was asking, she put in 26 inmate requests to see medical and nothing. She didn't get any response, didn't get taken out, or nobody came to see her. So, I mean, that's the type of things that happen in there. I mean, the medical is absurd there. Even mental health, I've had issues with certain things in there, and I needed to see it, and they don't respond. They don't.
Well, in related news about health conditions, last month, The Appeal wrote a story about a woman at CIW, Patricia Wright, who is 68. She's battling terminal cancer and is currently in chemo. In April, her doctors expressed concern that she's at high risk of contracting and even dying from COVID, but she's ineligible for release because she was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Colby, we've done a lot of shows about the aging population in prison. I mean, Patricia could die from COVID, and I mean, so many others.
Exactly.
Yeah, we got a lot of women there that are over the age of 50. I mean, with a lot of medical issues and stuff like that, and they don't care. It doesn't matter if you've got a life sentence, they ain't looking at you to even try to get out, even with commutation.
Yeah, and that's exactly why we've been pushing so hard for the release of medically vulnerable people, including so many of our elders inside, and Patricia Wright, Maria Arredondo, Lucia Bravo. There are so many. Laura and I could just name them on and on, hundreds of people who could be released immediately, who are completely safe to come home to our communities, who have family support. Some of them, like Patricia Wright, is already in end-of-life care. And, you know, she could be released to her family today and have an opportunity after a completely unjust sentence. And so that's the other thing, right? We are just completely, what is the word, kind of exhausted by the administration, by Governor Newsom, not looking at the highest risk people. CDCR not looking at the highest risk people, right? They are doing these moves to do quote-unquote early releases, which are actually releases that were already about to happen, and they should happen also. But we need priority for medically vulnerable, including elderly people, and we need that to not be based on extremely reductive assessments based on the type of conviction people have or the length of sentence in the case of life without parole. These things mean nothing about person's preparedness for release and safety for release. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, right, the recidivism rates for people serving long terms are incredibly, incredibly low. So I think, like Anoop said in the last segment, we need bold action immediately, like today, from the governor.
You know, I wonder from both of you, if this is 2020, and we have been doing shows about prisons. I've been hosting this show for almost 14 years. Every year we do show after show, week-long series after week-long series about what happens on the inside. And what I have seen change is there's a lot more awareness. The Black Lives Matter movement on the streets is raising, you know, concerns about this, talking about defunding police, you know, reforming this unjust system. But Colby, I just wonder, when we look at all the work, and there's so much work that has been done on the inside and on the outside, what has changed in terms of how people are actually treated? And, you know, when you're talking about the aging population, people with health issues on the inside, what has changed over the last 10 years?
That's a great question. We have changed, I would say, nothing. And in some ways, I think things are worse in terms of the aging population in prison, because the aging population is growing in prison, right? We continue to kind of leave our penal code in California in a way where people have these extreme sentences. And then inside, and Laura can attest to this too, the conditions for elderly people, you know, just get worse and worse and worse. There's people have to continue to work until they die, basically. The parole grant rate, despite having an elder, a quote-unquote elder parole program, actually has a lower grant rate than the entire population that goes up for parole, right? It really is abysmal. And so, I mean, even Governor Brown at the end of his term, I remember seeing a video where he talked about how the prisons have become geriatric wards. And I know that the organizers, family members, and incarcerated people at San Quentin are planning a press conference this Thursday, July 9th at noon outside of San Quentin, and they are trying to take Governor Newsom on a tour of the prison so that he can see things, you know, see the conditions as they are, which are horrible, and also see the aging population, people who are in wheelchairs and walkers, who should be released immediately.
And this is happening in California, where the Democrats have a supermajority in the Capitol in Sacramento.
Exactly.
So I, you know, doing these shows over the years, you just wonder what is happening in prisons in, you know, the deep South, where it's far away from a city and they don't have that many advocates. Of course, their family try to advocate them for as best as they can. But what's happening, and if it's this bad in California, what is it like in places where it's, you know, you can't really see what's going on?
Right. Yeah. We hear from organizers across the country, you know, facing very similar problems. And also, I think, you know, part of it is that there's this false idea that California is more progressive on some of these issues, right? And yet, we have a legislature that can just hardly pass, you know, ending enhancements of 1 year. You know, we worked so hard to get the felony murder amended to some degree, but it was just a dent in that problem. And then even in New York, you know, where it's supposed to be a more progressive state too, they're talking about creating basically a hospice prison right now instead of releasing people. And so, you know, we hear similar things to the South, and, you know, this system is beyond reform at this point. We need immediate releases, like, to save lives, and also massive, massive changes around obviously how we manage and approach harm, right, and also how we, you know, work to release our incarcerated elderly population. Mm-hmm.
Laura, what would you like to add in terms of what has or has not changed on the inside with all of this awareness raising happening right now?
Wow. I don't really see any changes. I've been out since 2018. I was a lifer as well. And just being in there with all these years, it's gotten worse.
And
they're just in the way of the communication. You're not even be able to, our voices are not heard, you know, and when things are going on and it just gets shoved under the rug. Like they just don't pay attention at all. I mean, you literally have to be bleeding or really hurt. I mean, on your deathbed for them to actually pay attention to something. So I don't see any changes. Really, I don't.
Well, thank you both for your work. We would love to have you back to just really continue talking about this and talking about what really happens on the inside. I mean, especially during this COVID crisis. Laura Hernandez is a former inmate at the California Institution for Women in Riverside. She's involved with advocacy efforts with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and the Young Women's Freedom Center. Colby Lenz is a former is a community organizer and legal advocate for the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and the Transgender Advocacy Group of California's Women Prisoners Organization. Colby and Laura, thank you so much. We'd also love to do another show about trans people in prison.
That would be great. I could definitely direct you to some powerful people.
Okay, thank you so much, and thank you for your work. We should also say that on Sunday, more than 100 people, including family members of incarcerated loved ones, gathered outside of Governor Newsom's home, calling on him to take more action in state prisons. They penned an emergency letter over the weekend calling for the emergency release of inmates. And I hope you can take the time to read this incredible piece by the Chronicle's Jason Fagone, Infected Inmates Journal Tells of Chaos in Women's Prison. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.